This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and our guest is Jim Bell. He is a physicist, he is a poet, he is a teacher, and here he is.
Sol y sombre, sun and shadow. The dead come unbidden to us, a fleeting memory. How real they seem for a transfixed moment. The warmth of her body pressing against yours, wanting the consummation. Only a word away, close, the thickness of a thin cotton dress around her, a lovely green pattern, like morality, painted upon it. So the fumbling fingers refuse the buttons. Still, there is less between us now, only the constantly shifting present, a pattern of light and shadow, what to make of it.
That's the voice of Jim Bell, J.H. Bell. And I'm glad he started with that poem because it shows we think of a scientist in a certain way, but today we see the heart of a scientist and no better way than with that poem. So I'll just tell you a little bit about him. As a physicist, he had his undergraduate degree from the University of Colorado, and then he served in the United States Air Force, got his Master of Science and PhD in Physics, both from the University of Maryland, and worked while at Maryland on the satellite projects at the Laboratory for Astronomy and Solar Physics, Goddard Space Flight Center. And ever since that day, he has been a physicist and a poet. And the reason that you're here today, Jim, is that you were one of the founding members of WPFW in 1977. We went on air together. And after the next poem, we'll take them down memory lane.
Okay, Grace. This is for William Meredith. The title poem is Republic, and it has some allusions to Plato's Republic in it, as well as to a movie called Five Easy Pieces that stars Jack Nicholson. Republic for William. I recall you when the sentences were not silence, your eloquence not a single stare. How one time in a fit of humor at the peak of an adversary, aside in my cramped kitchen, you confided, I think I'm beginning to get through to him. Always, the apologist for another's ignorance. In the way you smile now, you apologize for my own at not being able to enter into that world where the mind flicker shapes into existence, a dark theater not unlike the cave you try to climb out of, we try to climb out of. What I want to say is theater, really, yearning for a time when my life played grandly upon the stage, the wall of your memory. It is something like the scene in the movie Five Easy Pieces, when Nicholson's character on that promontory is kneeling before the old silent father's fierce, blank gaze, knowing the hardest piece is the future, tears on his face as he says, auspicious beginnings, we know I was never really that good at it anyway.
This is what a poet is. They line up words.
Thanks,
fierce, Grace. Blank gaze. Three one-syllable words that paint a portrait you cannot do in prose. This is J.H. Bell, Dr. Jim Bell, and we've known him for a very, very long time. But I want to go right back to that poem, Republic. First of all, who is William Meredith?
Well, as you know, William Meredith is quite a well-known poet, an old friend. He and Richard Hartice are. And he was the poet laureate, what would they then call the poetry consultant at the Library of Congress in, I think, 79, 80.
Exactly,
that's right. Era. And I was attending a reading or some sort and mentioned to him, I was at that time a Congressional Sciences Fellow at the Office of Technology Assessment for the Congress, working on public policy stuff. And I approached him and said, have you ever thought about doing a symposium on the relationship between science and literature? And it was ironic, but maybe fate moving in a certain direction. And he had apparently just had a conversation about that with some folks at the library.
And you did it.
He and Maxine Cuman were the principal engines behind it, and I helped.
Put it together.
Yep.
I remember 1981 mm-hmm. here at the library. It's time for another one.
I would think so.
And William is right now recovering from life-threatening surgery, but recovering.
Yep, I think he's out of the hospital bed now and sitting up and taking some of his first solid food. We've gotten very kind emails from Richard about his status. So
you're very connected with the library, with poetry, and with science, and those are three good paths to travel all the same time. When you were talking about Five Easy Pieces, how did you relate that to William in the poem?
Well, this was the time when just after he'd had his stroke, and so he wasn't able to speak. And so the attempt at conversation, the attempt at communication, reminded me of that scene in Nicholson's in the movie Five Easy Pieces. And they sort of all got admixed together and came out like that.
The exciting thing about being here with you is not only did we start together in 1977, and we look exactly the same, some miracle of science, and you have been so kind and generous to this program and every other poetry program, but William is part of that thread, and we're both friends of William, and mm-hmm. the symposium, and all these things seem to be coming together to fruition. But today, it is about you and your poetry, which is considerable, and I think probably gets the smallest percentage of your time.
It depends. Sometimes I write more. It's really pretty occasional.
Well, let's have something. Jim Bell at the Library of Congress.
Okay. On the subway. A boy like Michelangelo's David moves with the snake rhythm of the subway through the dark, then up into the staccato swirls of blinding light. The patterns are stirred and folded by the train surfacing into triangular shapes. His eyes close, his curious, sad eyes. Tranquility is everywhere upon his face, as surely as his skin is white marble. Yet there are details lost in the offhand slant of the sun. He does not see the ages draped about him. His own light orbits, oblivious to the porcelain circles of the ancient moon.
You know, a lot of sensuality.
Poets are sensual things, or ought to be.
A lot of color imagery. You're going to give me a whale look about this, but what is a physicist?
Well, a physicist is somebody that tries to make models of the world. They usually are highly mathematical models. I think the intuitions about the movements of the world come first, and then we tend to express them in mathematical systems. And there are a few million examples, of course.
That's a beautiful explanation, because right now we're attributing the invisible to physics and saying, you know, almost it's become almost a guru to be a physicist. What is it to be a poet?
Well, Wordsworth, in the 1800 preface to Lyrical Ballads, said that poetry was intense emotion recollected in tranquility, and it was the language of ordinary speech.
Can't do better than that.
I don't think I could.
So the methodology, though, for being a highly intuitive physicist and an observing poet aren't all that different.
They're not so different. I mean, the languages that we use are certainly different, but the intuitions about the hunches, if you will, about whether or not something fits together, like the Five Easy Pieces and Meredith's, William's condition, his inability to speak for a time, are both similar.
We need to have another symposium, because so much has happened in poetry with postmodernism and finding the essence as spirit, so that we need a new gathering. And I think we'll just put that on the back burner for a while.
On the list, okay.
But right now we want this, Jim Bell's poetry. And this is from the forthcoming book, Republic.
Yep, and with William's poem, the title poem of the book, Ricardo. And this is from an ended St. Vincent Millay poem, Ricardo. And I've got no idea where the rest of this comes from. So it just sort of came out of thin air, Ricardo. Her hands the saddened darkness touched once. The future is history. Her hair, the curve of her neck, gently following spaces held between muscle and bone, as though tension were the only metaphor for love. Look back. The mind is filled with shards of glass green of their own volition, or her eyes in a moment's repose before sleep, bruited of that color which sits above the horizon, culled from a litany of distance and blue. Of the future's hue, that opalescence we can find in. Nothing serves but the tin cup smell of water, warm on a dry, hot day, as it parts our lips, like another's tongue, without words.
Mm. That is a feeling of Donald Hall in the Romanticism. It's a very no-nonsense, matter-of-fact statement, highly charged, highly sensual.
That's high praise, Grace. Thank you.
It's high sex. And let's go on just for another one so they can get a real good sense of Jim Bell.
Okay, this is called Foxfire. Foxfire, as you may know, is when you're in the woods at night and you break open a log, the phosphorescent organisms will fluoresce, and there's a really pale, wonderful light comes from them. Without heat, by the way. A foxfire scattering of stars and a lone planet hang low over the northeast where the wind comes from. Down like a coyote, nose down, its warm tongue licking a chill out of the earth. The dawn's chill of stiff awakenings after the night's dancers, their supple sweat the way it loves its body, then sinks into salt rest. The earth last night sank so. Its blush and rose twilight giving up the light so well that those in their homes walked out into the roads and yards, arms folded, their skins flushed with an excitement drawn from the pink light, and discussed it. Not the coyote's old trail they stood on, but the huge evanescent cathedral of light that reared before them like a great dancer, his headdress streaming its eagle wildness, while they talked their awe of its wordless beauty.
Mm.
The subtle dawn, strewn with foxfire, now reclaims. It licks the wounds that words have made in us, that we, in that first step down, made of ourselves.
That one's going to last a long time.
Thanks, Grace.
That's a perfect poem.
Thanks.
Yeah. I think you like it a lot, too.
I do. Yeah. It was a distillation of a particular set of experiences. I was out in Santa Fe for a meeting and left the hotel I was staying at very early in the morning to get to the airplane and drove from Santa Fe down to Albuquerque. And there was this scene in the morning of the stars.
And you stopped and wrote that or took an image? Or
I wrote it
sitting there?
Yeah. Almost missed the plane.
I have to tell them that you left the conference early. I hate to report that on you, Jim, but my patriotic duty.
Oh, thanks, Grace.
But look what came out of it. That's almost a perfect poem, because true seeing is another way we can call poetry. True seeing. You saw something. But then the poem transcends, and that's the highest thing a poem can do, bigger than Jim, bigger than the foxfire, bigger than what he saw. The poem. What is the last line again?
It's, the last sentence, there are two and a half lines. It licks the wounds that words have made in us, that we in that first step down made of ourselves.
Did that come to you?
Well, I've always thought, you know, because I read old books, the Bible included, that some of the ideas about the fall that have been expressed symbolically in the Old Testament come from our acquisition of language.
Oh, I can feel another feature to the symposium. Science, the Bible, and literature. Now when there's so much controversy, don't you think that's a good symposium?
Well, I think the Bible is great literature.
Right, but some creationists and evolutionists and physicists, and I mean, there's a lot of conflicting things right now. We need a symposium.
I wouldn't object to it, certainly.
I like that answer. I have to say that in 1977, Jim hosted the Poet and the Poem more than once, I think, and accompanied by a dear departed friend, Robert Sargent, who died at 94 just recently this year. So there's a lot of things. History's in the room with us today. The beginning of WPFW is in the room with us. But we have to tell them the funny thing. But keep them on the hook until after the next poem. We will have to tell you about a preposterous thing Jim and I did on air that has never been repeated.
Yeah, there's a reason for that, actually.
Let's have a poem just to keep them on the hook.
Okay. This is Leonids. You know, a couple of years ago, there was this amazingly intense meteor shower of the Leonids, which seemed to radiate from the constellation of Leo the Lion. It's the debris from old comets, so and they're in an elliptical orbit around the sun. Sometimes the Earth passes through the debris cloud, and that's when we get these periodic showers, meteor showers. So the word prodigals comes in here. And because this material from the comets was left over from the beginning of the solar system, so that it's really the original clay that God made.
And we're made of it, too.
Yeah, we're made of it. And the title of the poem is Leonids. We were looking toward the other suns when the dark became another kind of light. There, upon their darkened faces, came a kind of blessing, the flush of a pale phosphorescence. Voices as of a choir or a crowd anointed, ood and odd, sibilant of a cathedral bare across the swept temple of the sky. The lesser children, the forgotten clay from whence God made us, has come home, and we so love prodigals.
I just learned that we were made of that same clay.
Mm-hmm. Press your fingers together, you know, that's the stuff that came from the stars. That's the current theory of how the solar system was formed.
I know. I heard the guy who's the head of the Hayden Planetarium say that very same thing. So I know it's true.
Mm-hmm.
This is Jim Bell, physicist. Now, we won't take a lot of time, but you tell me your impression of being the co-host of Writer's Workshop on the Air, and then I'll tell you what I remember. We haven't spoken of this for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Our memories may be different.
Well, I liked it a lot. I mean, it gave me a chance to get to know a couple of good friends, Robert Sargent and Pramod Ladd, who ended up at the Kaiser Research Laboratory before I lost track of him. He's a biochemist, and I got his PhD in theoretical chemistry from Cornell many years ago. And he and Robert and I would talk about poetry and actually critique manuscripts on the air.
On WPFW.
Which was something you actually let us do once or twice, which was amazed me.
More than once or twice. If anybody was going to go to jail, it wasn't going to be me. Because this was outrageous.
Yes.
We had everyone send in their manuscripts, and we had people sitting on the radio telling them what was right and wrong about it.
Yes.
And so what was your impression when you got a manuscript? What do you remember saying?
I'm glad that I don't remember a great many details about that conversation, because I'm sure that it would embarrass me now.
Oh, sure. It was in favor of the artist.
Yeah, it was basically the kind of stuff that you do with a friend to say, well, you know, this line's a problem, and I don't see why you've put the comma here, and wouldn't it be better if you inverted these two words, and don't you think this word is a little overused in your poetry or in somebody else's poetry?
Well, that sounds like it was better than I remembered. Because we got loads, tons of manuscripts. People were hungry for remarks. I went to Prince George's Community College and managed to get 3 credits given to people who did this, sent in their manuscripts, and they got college credits.
I know, I think that's...
And we sat as judge and juror. Oh, my.
It was it was at a time when the dinosaurs were gambling upon the face of the earth, and there's a reason they no longer are here.
So. Now, let's see. Where were you in your career in 1977? You were not yet teaching at St. John's.
No, I was working, let me see, 78, 77. I was finishing my PhD, which I finished in 78.
So we got you in a weakened condition,
right,
when you couldn't say no.
Right.
Jim Bell is here with us today celebrating our 30th anniversary on air, and he was very much a part of it. But in that time, he's done more than remarkable things. And after this poem, I'm going to tell you a little bit about him.
Okay, Morning at Midnight for Mary Ruth Clance. A midnight's fancy in its tone resolves a deeper chord, and hues the shades would fit on evening lay like cats upon a purry climb. All resonate, and thrust upon the tautest edge, would strop and trust to make the evening so. Thus violate, the sleeping lover lies, and in the carnal bed so troubled with repose, tranquility of edges in a breath of sighs, demarking dreams all literate, suppose. Yet here upon the dark incontinence of sleep, mass continents of thoughts the mind itself would not have dreamed, where toppling high meridians alone in keening silence fall, as should a great tree fall in dark and soundless wood.
Satin. Incontinence of sleep?
The dark incontinence of sleep.
And then do you use the word continence
yeah,
after that?
Yeah. A play, obviously, on continent as the landmass and incontinence.
The sound, though, is what makes the thing, because that you are still of the school of music, poetry as music.
Oh, well, I think poetry is music. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the strangest of art because it uses the human voice. You know, there's this old in Homer's Iliad in the first part where Agamemnon and Achilles are going about to slaughter one another because Agamemnon has demanded his prize from the wars. Achilles has his hand on his sword and he says to Agamemnon, "You sack of wine." And Nestor says, "What has escaped the barrier of your teeth?" But it's precisely the what escapes us.
The barrier of your teeth.
Of course, Achilles was saying this with teeth clenched, but Homer knows that it's more about the articulation of speech, the speech in act, you know, the words in the air. That's what poetry is really about. All of Homer was spoken at one point before it was written.
Of course. Do you teach that? St. John's?
Yeah, well, we talk about it a fair amount. You know, we have these seminars and we read the texts.
Let's go into that. Since 1982, you have been a professor at St. John's College.
Mm-hmm. We call ourselves tutors, though.
Oh, that's what a tutor is.
Yeah, we just sit around and ask questions. And we don't profess a particular discipline. We all try to teach
everything. It's not like Writer's Workshop on the air where you knew all the answers.
Yeah, no, I've learned since to be a more modest soul.
Well, I know that you teach science there. Literature there, mathematics there. Do you teach Latin also?
We don't have Latin anymore. We have two languages. We have Attic Greek, and we have French, and I've taught both of those. Yeah, the Attic Greek is the first year, and then the first semester of the second year language tutorial.
Does everyone have to teach to teach Latin, math, physics, literature to be a tutor? I mean, do you have to be superhuman to be a tutor?
I don't think it's superhuman. We just try to do one thing at a time, and we all try to teach everything. I've taught almost the whole program. I've not yet taught freshman laboratory, nor have I taught sophomore music, but I intend to do that.
I saw your picture on the front page of the paper the other day working with, I think it was a telescope.
A planetarium. It's the old Spitz A2 projector we used for the mathematics tutorials. Because Ptolemy was the first, we study a lot of Ptolemy. He was the first mathematical theory of the movements of the world. And so all of modern physics is the direct lineal descendant of that mathematical model he used, with the epicycles and things like that. It's really quite amazing.
Are you happy?
Yeah, I'm a happy man.
You are, really. You have such a fulfilled life. Now, we used to say St. John's, and then we'd say, oh, that's the 100 Great Books program. Is that an old-fashioned way to... Isn't that what it used to be?
Well, it's a bit of a misconception because it's not just books. It's scientific papers and laboratory experiments and the mathematics textbooks. Our first mathematics is Euclid's Elements, which is the first 13 books of Euclid.
That's the first mathematics you teach is Euclid?
Mm-hmm.
Does someone have to be spectacular in their grades to get in?
No, they have to be interested in reading old books.
Ah, what a good answer.
And we have a lot of students who are less than successful in high school and some that are just spectacularly successful, and after a few days you can't tell the difference.
I don't know why anyone would want to leave there.
We have trouble getting them out the door. I'm just kidding. But they do, it's a good place. It's a very good place.
I am.
It's a good place to teach. It's a good place to study. The teaching is very much like graduate education at the level of the dissertation because you're reading original works and trying to make some sense of them.
Is everything from your own library or do they go elsewhere?
For example, we have books that are, quote, on the program and then books that aren't. But sometimes in the essays, the students will bring in outside sources.
If somebody wants to study with Dr. Jim Bell, can they sign up?
Well, we don't accept transfers.
You have to start fresh? You don't accept transfers?
Nope.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Because there's no real
way to mesh that.
Right.
J.H. Bell. Let's hear some more. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're celebrating today.
This is the Carnival Barker's song. A little bit about poetry. This melancholy light bleeds longer into evening each successive day. And the clouds look like the rump end of earth had flung her white tail high up, curling into the wild current of the inhibitionless void, gaily. Things go from orange to lavender, and the night settles into the old routine of stars, like a carnival barker who knows his wares. Here's Orion, and notice how the red jewel there in the hunter's shoulder, studded armor for the pain his arrow brings. Bright red, an eye in heaven looking out for blood. That's Betelgeuse. Now, folks, don't think that I'm not serious. He doesn't think about his words. He knows them so well. And his audience? Yes, there's the same skeptic in the front row, arms folded in a kind of sneer. Mostly believers, though, their faces upturned in an awe reserved for auspicious occasions, as the stars come gently from their realm onto the dark curtains of his stage.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest is James Bell, Jim Bell. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're back with Jim Bell, who is a poet, physicist, teacher, humanitarian, philanthropist, and scholar. I don't know what else a person needs to be, really. Married to a physician himself and the father of a wonderful son.
And daughter who is an artist.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I met her.
She's in Scotland
now. Oh, I forgot
now.
Totally. Because she's older. I always think of the young boy.
Yeah.
And how old is she now?
She's in her 30s.
Our age.
Mm-hmm.
It all happened at once. Is
right,
there something
Grace.
In physics, like the quantum theory
yes.
of physics, where we all become the same age?
Yep.
Jim Bell has, after working as a congressional science fellow, technology assessment, I hope that was of some value. Because, you know, you hear about programs that come to naught. I mean, was that a valuable thing to do?
Well, it was really valuable for me. Because I got to learn how Congress works. And I came away with a lot of respect for the enterprise. It's interesting, there's this old Russian proverb. May I say this in Russian?
Please.
Pravda yesni izvestia, izvestia yesni pravda. Izvestia and pravda are the, izvestia is news and pravda is the truth.
Well, we're all Russian speakers here, so go right
okay.
ahead.
And the proverb is, there's no news in the truth and no truth in the news.
Say that one more time.
There's no news in the truth, and no truth in the news. And, of course, it predates the communist era by millennia, practically, for the Russians. But I think that most of the people in the Congress that I had any dealings with were most of the members of Congress were very serious people working very hard. The problem is that the ones you hear about, for the most part, are the ones that make mistakes.
So, that's good to hear, Jim.
And I think that's if we remember that proverb, it'll help us in thinking through a lot of things.
That's heartening, especially because science is sagging so badly now in mm-hmm. terms of budget there. Well, science and poetry come together in one man. And this is a new book. What is your dream publisher? Who is your dream publisher?
Gosh, I don't know.
Norton, maybe.
Okay.
W.W. Norton. Shall we put that out in the universe?
Sure, why not?
Okay, here we go, Norton. Here's your next poem.
This is for Paris, and it's for a friend of mine, Paris Christopher Pacchione, who's abandoned us and gone down to Georgia for warmer climes, but he was on the board of directors of the WordWorks for many years.
Designed my first book cover.
Indeed. And as a really gifted artist in that respect, as well as others. But this is thought about Paris in the 20s and about what Washington might be. Before eternity and fortune descend like archangels and bestow upon the times the halo of certainty, let us revel in this twilight lost to public view. Raise this glass carefully to these lips. See no aura of light through the long lens of history. Only taste fine wine shot with its own luminescence of the physical that knows that only friends are true.
Does he like that poem?
I think he likes it. Yeah, he's got it on his wall. So it was, it's an old
one. This is really bringing back so many souls in this room today. Mentioning WordWorks, I believe you co-founded that with Deirdre Baldwin in 75.
Yeah, I was more involved. I was involved in some of the early incorporation and discussions of it.
And let's face it, you wrote all the grants. Let's be honest.
Basically, I wrote some of the grants that helped us get the WordWorks started.
And still do.
And then I was more directly involved in the founding of the Washington Prize, which is the poetry competition.
You founded the Washington Prize, and tell the world what that is.
It started out as a prize for a single poem from a living American poet from a nationwide poetry competition, and grew from that after the first few efforts into a book prize, which it currently runs. We're in fact accepting manuscripts now for the Washington Prize for this run this year.
So, how many manuscripts do you get?
It varies. I guess 300-400. Miles Moore is going to kill me if I get this wrong, but hopefully I've got that right. 300-400 manuscripts.
Are you like one of the last judges? It's culled from readers, and then you are one of the final judges?
I typically am one of the second readers. Sometimes I'm a first reader. Sometimes I'm a final judge. We sort of rotate.
So the WordWorks is something that is very much in your DNA and vice versa. It was one of the first publishing houses in Washington.
Yeah, along with Washington Writers Publishing House and...
Right.
But yes.
But you have time to still serve on that board. That is what I'm getting at. That is what impresses me the most, that you're with the satellites, you're with Euclid, and you have time to go to the board meetings for the WordWorks. I mean, how many hours are you expanding in a day? Can physicists expand time? Now, I guess that's my question.
Well, I mean, you know, you asked me if I was a happy man. A little bit ago, and I think Aristotle's definition of human happiness is probably the best one in the Ethics. He says the happiness is the use of all of one's capacities in the pursuit of the highest things. And I think if you try to live like that, and clearly I don't all the time.
Well, I know now where Warren Buffett got it, because I heard him on TV say happiness is getting a chance to do what you can do very well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of the same, but not as lovely.
Yeah, I think it's not surprising that there is an agreement between some very old books and people who live that kind of life like Warren Buffett does currently, because people haven't changed much.
And prosperity isn't all material.
No, in fact, it's the least interesting of things.
You are the most interesting of things. Jim Bell is at the Library of Congress, and I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we have been together not often enough in 30 years, but today's the day.
Yep. This is Wendy, after the Peter Pan story. So. At first each day, she expected at the window a faint tapping, not unlike the new bud tossed in a spring breeze, its index prodding quizzically the cold, flat pain, but different. Night again come alive. Then the years, like a mist obscuring, softened the longing pain, and she wondered that it might have been a dream. Her husband held her, and she woke as a princess, whose cheeks, like pink blossoms, held a living promise, children and her father's house. Where, after many years, the tapping came again, late one night, and perhaps because of the nature of love, or the imperative of dreaming, instead of rebuke, she opened wide the windows and gave her children to it.
Mm. Good last line. Good last line. Let's hear another.
Okay. Solstice on the first watch. There is no magic. What we perceive as lightning, wending its electric way along the surface of the skin, is only silence, or the whispered dance of chemicals and electric fields that move like ocean waves through us in our private sea. Thus, those lights in the sky, auroral curtains of translucent ice-green fire, resolve themselves when we focus as abstractions of the abstract impulse of nerve on nerve in mindless dark. Still such movements sometimes overwhelm our doubts with the heat that shimmers in the way light does, when it seems to walk on the surface of water like the original solstice did. And rumors can float lightly on the tongue, and sinuous words take root that something happened. What we hold as true is true, perhaps, but the nets of words cast along some shore of meaning circumscribe. For instance, that time when the doubting soldiers, drawn from their game of bones, saw something moving in the dim hours of the fourth watch along the edge of the sea, then out on it, the figure of a singular man walking, the image of water touching his feet.
What is the title of that one again?
Solstice on the First Watch.
So you take a phenomenon and you evoke a phenomenon, actually. Then what we have, you almost have no punctuation. I mean, it's just like one long ribbon. There are long phrases that go from stanza to stanza or within the stanza.
Yep.
There's not much punctuation or abrupt stops. And then there's always a historical reference, it seems.
There's a lot of those, yeah.
A philosophical umbrella. So all this, I was just listening to this and seeing all of these aspects that are typical of you and not other poets. And there's sort of a philosophical underpinning, I think, to almost each poem. Jim Bell has also been a prominent in Washington in a way which is not always known. 30 years ago, Washington, D.C. was more of a divided city than it now is. At that time, Jim developed, or helped, I think, mm-hmm. with a project called In the Shadow of the Capitol.
Yes.
At the Folger.
That's correct.
Remind us what that was.
Well, it was a project on the history of the black intellectual community in Washington, D.C. between 1925 and 1963. 1925 was picked by Betty Perry, who was the person who was the architect of the project, because there was a major Ku Klux Klan march on Washington at the time, when it was really a much larger and more difficult and troubling organization than it is now. It's bad enough now. And then the 1963 was, I believe, the March on Washington, is that? And it was the history of the black intellectual community, people like Rayford Logan, Montague Cobb, Sterling Brown, Mae Miller Sullivan, these sort of monumental figures. And I just wrote the grants for it and tried to help Betty organize it a little bit. But
and it happened. It actually happened.
Yeah, it was a symposium at the Folger Library.
Was it a two-day?
It was a two-day symposium. And they talked about what it was like to live in a segregated city. And it was really very interesting for a number of reasons.
Do we have records?
We have tapes of it and transcripts of the tapes. And hopefully at some point they will see daylight. They've been given to the library, I believe, as part of Betty's effort, the library here. But it was difficult, I think, for the people in the audience, many of them in the black community now, to understand how they survived this. And one of the answers that kept ringing in my ears was that they said, we went to the public libraries, they were never segregated, they were always free, we made our own lives. That's a difficult statement, given the kinds of things if you read the details of the transcripts, it's clear that there were really tough times. But the people, like, they helped found the medical school at Howard, and people of that ilk, was really quite an amazing thing. There's one other story about this I have to tell. It's that I introduced them to my daughter, who was then 6 years old or something like that. And it was as though there was no one else in the room. They paid absolute attention to her. And they didn't really know from Adam who I was, because they heard the name, I guess, but didn't know. We'd never met Rayford Logan anyway. And it was just a really wonderful experience. Shows the kind of people they were.
That is going to be very much brought to light. That is going to be, I think it has been pointed to by present-day scholars, mm-hmm. but I believe this needs to have a big light shown on it, because these venerable people are dead now, Sterling Brown, Mae Miller,
yep.
and they were present, I think.
Yeah, they were in the symposium. They were in their 80s at the time, typically. I think Mae Miller was was in her 70s, late 70s?
Well, that was, you know, if you just did that in your lifetime, that'd be okay.
It was a good time. It was a wonderful project to be involved with. And Betty was the mover and shaker on
it. And she's gone, too. So yeah. We are actually calling, sending a sunbeam to the spirits today, because so many people have made Washington such a rich poetry city.
Mm-hmm. That's really true.
James Bell has read his poetry various places at the Poetry Project, Baltimore, the Martin Luther King Library, the Potter's House in Washington, the Folger, the Miller Cabin series, and in Annapolis on WAMU, Voice of America. Now, when you worked with this Russian composer, was it your poem put to music?
Yes. Yeah, it was. I was in Moscow giving a lecture on astrophysics, and Vladimir Lipanov, who was a colleague, found out that I wrote poetry. He was one of the people that set up the talk, and he introduced me to Leonid Timoshenko, who was an astronomer who turned composer, and so showed him some of the poems, and one of them, a poem called Easter, which ended up being titled Jerusalem in the musical form, was the one that won the Foreign Service Prize.
It won the Radio Moscow Foreign Service Prize for the best English language poem put to music by a Russian composer.
It was such an accidental thing, it's hard to believe actually happened now.
But don't you think that everything almost is, that providence, the cards that pop up for us, we can't imagine sometime?
Yeah, I think the world's a fractal.
The world's like, a fractal.
Knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted I should ever be back, the Frost poem.
Do you ever get tired of your students? I mean, since 1982, you've been teaching Euclid, and is it always changing?
It's always changing. I have very good students. They're wonderful.
And do they bring ideas to you?
You bet. Yep. They're like little baby tigers wrestling with stuff. And then they grow up and be really serious older tigers and go off and do interesting things. They go into public policy. They go into science. They go into literature. One of them is working on fundraising for ballet here. Things like that.
A happy man.
Morning of the Apocalypse. A bit more serious of a note. There are four parts. Do not speak to me of lamb's old sharp tooth, with your glittering eye half squint in that sideways cut rock of the head that reckons marrow in its crunchy bite. I know the world and your part in it. 2. Morning of the apocalypse, the sun becomes a funeral pyre, burning at the rim of earth, then later the saffron light that falls across the city like a translucent cloth. 3. Some parts continue running on. The ant world of the anthill. The mind on its treadmill of self. 4. As you drift towards sleep, think of her white skin as a landscape barren as winter, the blue sky holding back heaven, a heaven that waits only for evening, waits only for the stars to begin to fall.
Is the poem a unified field?
You're referring to the unified field of physics, physical theory. We don't really have one, you know. In fact, it was Einstein's dream that he worked on, the theory of everything. And it's that, I guess, golden chalice is something that people are still working on.
We don't have a unified field?
No.
And you've been working all these years, and we still don't have one?
I've not devoted myself completely to it, Grace. I'm sorry.
You've been a busy man. Oh, we don't have a unified field. That's the theory of everything?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. I didn't know that was the theory of everything.
Well, there are different, people have called it different things, but the world is such an interesting and complicated place. It might be that as we learn things, we will not ever close off the possibilities of learning more, and therefore there'll be more and more things to explain.
What a way to live.
It's an interesting time. That's both a good
More interesting than ever?
Oh, yeah. This is the best time to be alive ever, without doubt.
Because?
We know more about the world. We're learning more about ourselves, both in the way that we behave as we always have and in the way that we behave in different circumstances.
Should we send scientists out to be ambassadors? They seem so logical and so kind.
I think we have to send people who have a deep understanding of human nature. So,
amen.
Scientists would be among them, hopefully. Poets as well.
Amen. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. I'm with Dr. Jim Bell, J.H. Bell, talking about his new manuscript. We're going to talk about his older book, Hickey the Days, in just a minute. So let's hear another new poem.
Okay. This one's a bit long, but it's called Red-Winged Blackbird at Gettysburg Field. And I can explain the circumstances of it in a bit. One, we linger to read the gentle lines of land that the land makes, caused somehow by the layers of rock below these peaceful fields. We talk under a copse of trees, mostly for shade from the sun. A red-winged blackbird alights and bobs on distant sage, then launches itself toward the canopy above us. Before it disappears, hurtling into the fractured darkness of the trees, its two chevrons, brilliant orange-red on black wings, flashes against the fractal blues and greens of the tree and sky. The wind shifts. The words flutter to us of soldiers' battles and old wars. Two. It is certain that these red-winged were here in that time when for 3 days before a kind of resurrection, the fates gave Lee his time to pose grandly upon the stage of history. Perhaps he saw them bobbing and diving, crimson chevrons showing before the cannons fired their first volleys and they fled. These soldiers of the sky. So too the soldiers of the earth whose lies were strewn about like litter, like false papers, rent from a kind of dark book, not unlike history. They too would have gladly turned to stare and share the sights of blackbirds and bright wings. Three. In the beginning there was the plan, the general thought out, so perfect in his mind, a plan like a grammarian's composition. His will done in directing each element of his army, the march of soldiers arriving too early and too late, the desperate scrabble hand over hand up the bloody hill into the face of an enemy not unlike ourselves. And then the words seem to come to become bidden. The terrible gentle words after the burial, the buried dead, and the wailing after the rain sows ashes wet and black into the old earth. Four. Thus the cause, these ideas, these shadows spawn, the orange ball of the setting sun, which promises a fair tomorrow, red at night, red through the dark clouds gathering, red like the chevron wings of innocence which know nothing of thoughts, red like the blood soaking into the fields from the mindless dead. Yet we remember, brothers, fathers, comrades, friends, the terrible bloody mark on his arm as the bullet first sang and slept through it, then the second, then the fall. Five, we come to ponder, to feel the weight of leaden ages which have brought us to this place. It is only natural to speak of it, I suppose, to remember not the deeds but the words. There was Pericles whose speeches became a city and an effigy of war. Here Lincoln gave us his great equivocation upon a hallowed ground. I see them, or the idea of them, with the wind tugging at their clothes, the upturned faces longing to understand a cause, as the late sun, shrouded, becomes a crimson band upon a dark wing.
Jim Bell, the reason that poem works is because it telescopes into that terrible bloody slash on his arm?
Yeah, the terrible bloody mark on his arm as the first bullet sang and slept through it, then the second, then the fall.
Here we come from a huge scene of history, and then you just home in, and what makes it really work is that slash, that bloody part of an arm, because that's what it comes down to when that first bullet went. And it could serve as a poem for today, couldn't it?
Yeah, that has occurred to me.
It's happening again.
It's as human beings are, like they always were, it will probably happen again. It's certainly happening now.
That's an epic poem. A little bit longer than some of your other poems, but you're not afraid of long poems.
No. I write them typically in sections.
I was wondering how long that took you.
Yeah.
Altogether from the inception, do you know?
Oh, I worked on it pretty intensely for several days, and then over a course of several months, refined it. So I do revise a lot, but I will typically try to set time aside when something like this is cooking to focus on it.
Do you go away on vacations and just take poetry?
No. I just take time wherever I am.
You just take time wherever you are. Jim Bell, we're going to hear a few more. I do want to talk about Hickey the Days just because I was there at the birth.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to you, Hickey the Days, what? Tell me about that title. I remember this when it came out. And you said it was part of a long sentence.
Right.
And then what was that?
Well, it started, and it just came unbidden. It was just out of thin air. I was looking at a scene near where I lived. And, but the long sentence, I'll read the poem.
Oh, yeah. Yes, please. Okay. Is it in there?
Yep. Hickey, the days are whiter than the sky. And this weather that the snow makes up like stories of some after Christmas night. When the songs lull themselves to sleep is filled with smoke and blue winter warm on the unused buttons of my coat. The quiet sleeps in my ears and the wind rustles the city, its many faces like leaves only for an instant. Then the sound returns by way of a distant cab horn that echoes, starts an avalanche of soft sound falling on my ears like snow. Hickey, if I would, I could tell you what the weather is, where it leads and burns my skin. And I go on like this for hours, like leaves, my dry skin with your sweet touch. I sleep. This is far away to tell an echo of mountains from the plains and tell the flatness, toll it out like bells. I would want you knowing how the weather goes, the shift of seasons as they come and curl around us that begins. I try to feel. I could ask all else. Would not you give me night, a cup of it so warm and black that I can drink and feel the burning as the center goes? Hickey, I have tried some magic on you. When the sky fills up with grayness, tombstones, and they march on happiness, the fort. Indians would. I stamp the dust, then mud, get mostly wet. For all this, I have lost nothing, shades, horizons, my front yard. White winter later and bare trees, your face in puddles, the rain ripples. Sets it all to mind, my giving up. I love you well enough and will not.
That is so much like you, and yet is so different from your present poems.
Yeah, they've evolved a lot.
But it is definitely, I would definitely know a Jim Bell poem. But that was the first time I ever saw an abstracted title for a book that didn't in itself, it suggested. And it was like very, very provocative at the time when you were one of the first almost postmodern title persons, if I can say that, by breaking a thought in half and just putting Hickey the Days with people having no idea where it was going and where it had come, but extremely arresting. And do you still like that book?
I do, yeah. I still think the poems hold up pretty well.
Mm.
The next one is called Motorcycle Ride at Midnight. That's for Tom Horn, who's a man, an old friend, and who had a remarkable fascination with large and dangerous machines.
Was he Deirdre's husband?
Yes, Deirdre Baldwin's husband. Still is around and still flying airplanes. My vision yellows in the faceplate, turning the moon and clouds the color of old milk. The patient numbing fingers of the wind begin their stitching, needles working in. We wed the thread of cold air to our bones. The road we ride on, in this frictioned night, pitched over the rolling land before us, through the halt and distant convergence of the trees, sings to us in the tires. And though the round gauges float and feather as an afterimage of the night the cars burn holes in, we go on and on. You touch the button of the horn. A frail sound, a thin eggshell of air, expands into the wind.
You knew that one by heart.
Yep. Yeah, I like it a lot. Partly for the sort of vivid memory of it, you know, which
is the great thing about the listener can get into the poem and lose herself so that when you really are with a fine poet, you lose your ego because you enter their poem. And that's a good thing. It's a spiritual thing.
Thanks, Grace. Somewhere in antiquity, this comes from the ontogeny recapitulating phylogeny. There's a place in the...
Would you please say that again?
Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny.
Couldn't have said it better myself, Jim.
Thanks. Well, you know, it's I'm not sure if it's biologically a relevant concept anymore, but there's a place in the womb where a fetus in its development has something, a structure that looks like gills and a tail. So there's some sort of recapitulation of our ancestry. So somewhere in antiquity. The wet that cascades the salt wash off his body catches and holds a light almost gelatinous. A film of soap webs her fingers, and where the gills were, a pulse beats like a clock that lives to tell time. Dendritic, the nerves shed the warp and woof of movement, stirring like branches in a high wind. Ticking in her belly, the metronome that orders each successive growth from cell to organism, shifts the patterns, tracing the lines of all the faces that ever lived. She lifts her arms. I think of two, for a moment, somewhere in antiquity, who became trees.
And a final poem.
Tankers for Tara Siobhan Bell, my daughter. These lights, as cities harborings of distant coasts, trace silently the horizons and their own communion. No less an intricate pattern than the lace wings goes beyond the grove of tall pines. Incessantly is the pounding of surf. Again and again, without comment, they pass to destinations burdened by the curve of earth. Triangulations of the shifting land and the stars' arcs guide them. Echoes that probe beneath their oceans tell of the contours there. What lost Atlantis flecks from time to time their deeps may make stories for children told at the bell of a closing day. For now the mariners' faces are lit with the instrument's dim red glow. Of the imperatives that launch them and set their course beyond into the reach of their own mythologies, there is no clue. These gossamer networks, half metallic, half light, winking in and out beyond the trees, and our conjectures here, based on imperfect knowledge, lead us to beliefs certain as the beacons on a rocky shore, where waves' tumults finger the white air into a kind of song.
Of the imperatives that launched them, the voice of Jim Bell. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production is by Michael Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Motion Picture Broadcasting and Sound Division of the Library of Congress. The Poet and the Poem is celebrating 30 years on air. Associate producer is Kenneth Flynn. The program is made possible by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry with assistance from the WordWorks, presenting poetry programs since 1975. Our engineer is Brad McCoy. I'm Grace Cavalieri.